It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
And let me hear from the plaintiffs, and let me first ask about, is there any evidence that the personal representative of Viotta's estate or Jack Kowalski as Maya's parent has suffered any damages? And then we can talk separately about whether Jack Kowalski individually has suffered damages. But is there any evidence on the estate itself being damaged because of the bills?
Well, someone was still owed the bills, Your Honor. They haven't all been paid. Mr. Kowalski, I believe, testified he paid.
Right, but I don't recall hearing evidence that the estate owed any bills, and I don't recall hearing any evidence that Maya Kowalski
owed the bill. On Maya, I would agree.
Because right now, count 18, I have three different plaintiffs bringing the same count, and I'm beginning to think, I agree with Mr. Altenburn, that it probably really, if it exists, is really only Jack Kowalski individually and not the other two.
Your Honor, we had this discussion a while back about the liens, and we put that into evidence, a little controversy about it. But wouldn't the estate be responsible for some of those liens, as well as the PR? I mean, as well as Jack Kowalski as the parent and guardian of Maya.
Was there a claim made in the estate by the hospital? I mean, can legally the...
These aren't bills for Beata. These are bills for Maya.
Yeah, so, they were bills for Maya. So,
and Beata was the parent.
The parent.
Right.
And so was there ever a claim made in Beata's estate for payment of bills?
Well,
and I don't think there was any testimony to that effect.
I don't think there was either, Judge.
Assume that to be true, then if the estate is not legally liable for any bills, then how can it have a claim?
Well, I guess our point is yet, but depending on the outcome of the case, there may well be a claim. And again, we get into the same argument we had before, which is the contingent nature of these liens. And so they can be enforced against either parent, really. So we won't know on that until... Really, it's the chicken or the egg thing.
Well, when it comes to claims in the estate, there's a bar date. And I would submit we are well beyond the bar date. Even if the hospital was not notified of Beata's death, which obviously doesn't seem to make sense here, but even if we were to assume that, we're much beyond the bar date. So I don't think anyone can, unless someone made a claim in the estate, I don't think the estate would ever owe any money relative to the bills at this point. And Mr. Allegate, am I under...
Let's talk about Jack.
We understand the court's position.
Yeah, let's talk about Jack. Your Honor, there's the big picture, I think, is you've got the hospital telling these parents, you shouldn't have CRPS. Effectively, doing more than telling, and we've already been through some of that. And at the same time, they're billing the insurance company, I don't know how many hundreds of entries, but apparently for CRPS in the billing codes. And I understand there's in Exhibit 2438, Aetna messages that Beata had with Aetna. So you've got, you've got a risk management notes, you know, about the lesions not and not being complex regional. You've got all this stuff going on that says it's not this, and then you're billing and saying it is. That seems like fraud. That seems like, why are you telling the insurance company this? I mean, maybe there was a higher rate. That's not, I don't think the plaintiffs have to explain why they did what they did. You have that taking place. You have a false statement of material fact. Representatives acknowledge that the representation is false. Well, they're telling, on the one hand, they're saying it's not this and they're billing for it. Intention, representation, induce another to act on it. Well, why do you send bills? You send bills to get paid. They clearly intended the parents and Aetna to rely on it. And you have consequent injury by the person acting in reliance on it. Some of these bills were paid. Mr. Kowalski's paid. I understand, testified he paid toward one of the bills. There's a big chunk of bills still out there. So I think you have all four of those elements here.
Quick response. Is there a burden first to prove it was a material fact? Material fact is a fact that makes a difference in the billing. And the only way you do that is putting on billing experts one side or the other to explain how these things are billed under the complex Medicare system that we use for billing these days. There's no evidence that this is material. There's no evidence that John Hopkins was intentionally putting something on a bill to defraud them or the insurance company. And without regard to the damage numbers and the like, the front end of this is the problem. They haven't put on the witnesses that they need to do this. I mean, we've got to put hours of people on the stand from the billing department to explain why this is done in the normal fashion. But we shouldn't have to do that because they haven't come forward with anything to prove that there's a material misrepresentation and that we knew it was false and that we sent it out relying on people to do something improperly.
Madam Clerk, so the court minutes are clear. There's three different plaintiffs in count 18. So as it relates to count 18, where the plaintiff is the personal representative of Beata's estate, I'm going to grant the motion. There's no evidence that the estate is responsible for these bills. Therefore, there would be no damage to the estate. And therefore, the count 18, as it relates to the personal representative of the estate, is out. With respect to the claim by Jack Kowalski as the parent of Maya Kowalski under count 18, same result. I'm going to grant the directed verdict motion because there's been no evidence that Maya is legally responsible for those bills. With respect to count 18, as it relates to Jack Kowalski in his individual capacity, I'm going to take that motion under advisement. But Mr. Altenburn, have your team call those people towards the end, because I'm pretty much in your camp on this. I want to look at a couple of things, but I think count 18 is not going to survive. So I would put that evidence in later and give me a chance to.
The next count is count 20, which is the fraudulent concealment of the videotape.
Your Honor, can I make one additional point on that previous, if you're going to continue considering it?
Sure.
The Aetna messages at 2438, there's been this issue as to allocation amongst the various diagnoses. I would only ask the court to take a look at those messages when Beata Kowalski asked that direct question: what is this billed for? Aetna does not come back with a list of 4 or 15 different diagnoses. They tell her one: complex regional pain syndrome. That's what those bills were for, according to Aetna, in their own words.
Well, what exhibit number are those again?
2438.
2438. Okay, thank you. So we're now going on to the next motion, and we're on count 20.
Yes. And this is a fraudulent concealment of the videotape. I'd emphasize that this does not account for making the tape as a violation of privacy. And in the allegations in paragraphs 210 to 213 of the Eighth Amendment complaint are allegations that we knew it contained exculpatory evidence and that it would be useful in the DCF proceeding and that we had a duty, therefore, to disclose it to them. And that because of that, they had to go out and hire psychiatric and renowned medical experts in an attempt to prove information that JHAC already had on this videotape. Now, for fraudulent concealment, you have to prove that John Hopkins concealed or failed to disclose one or more material facts by not disclosing the videotape. And by the way, the parties are pretty well agreed on these elements. So they're from the tobacco industry has made us lots of good jury instructions on this. And whether we knew the facts should be disclosed and whether we knew its concealment or failure to disclose the material fact would induce Mr. Kowalski or Beata Kowalski to act or refrain from acting, and whether we had a duty to do this, and whether they detrimentally relied upon that information in these circumstances. Now, to be clear, they didn't know we made the video, and they didn't know about it until it was delivered to their lawyer on, I believe it's what, the 17th of November, about 30 days after it was made. But the plaintiffs, first of all, they haven't even put this video in to see what is on it.
The video's in. I know there's...
Yes. Two little segments are in, not the whole thing. Four segments. Okay, we got 2 minutes of 48 hours in evidence. And they show various things that we can fight about what it is they mean. But we don't have the whole thing in. But nevertheless, what they really don't have is that evidence from JHAC that anybody in that 30 days reviewed it and said, oh, my gosh, there's evidence that is exculpatory. We have to disclose that. There's no evidence that anybody did that or came to that conclusion. And as a result, it should end there. But even if we did that, they have to show that they did something that was detrimental to them. Now, we know that they hired Dr. Duncan, but that was because that was ordered by the Shelter Court on October 14th at the hearing. They couldn't visit their daughter until those things were done. And I'm not exactly sure when they were done from when Dr. Duncan was on the stand, but my impression was done that they were done sometime in early November. There's nothing saying that they hired her to have exculpatory evidence at trial from that point in time. They didn't hire Chopra as an expert until well later than this. So the question is, who got on the stand and said that there were things that were done in the 30 days after November 17th, or even from November 17th to the end of the case, things they would have done in that first 30, either they would have done in the first 30 days or wouldn't have done in the first 30 days, if only they had known about the exculpatory evidence that is on this video. And that evidence is simply not here in the record. So without regard to whether the plaintiff is one or all three of these plaintiffs, there's no evidence that there was fraudulent concealment of that videotape.
I think this one has only brought Jack in his individual capacity, Jack as parent of Maya Kowalski.
Okay.
At least that's what my notes have.
Okay. So often it says plaintiffs, and I get worried.
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sure I'm going to need some factual help on this one, too. But let's start with the elements. They had a duty to disclose this. Under the Patient's Bill of Rights, there was no medical, as I understand it, there was no notation made in the medical record of this video. So hard to see how they were doing it for a valid medical reason. They wait until after the November hearing to disclose it. They wait 30 days to disclose it. So they can argue about what's exculpatory or what's not, but they concealed it. They kept it from the parents until after that time. And I think Dr. Newberg and Dr. Corcoran both testified to the need to have disclosed this type of thing. Okay, we talked about the medical record. Exhibit 2116, I believe, is that document. At one level, it's a little odd to think about how you say you rely on something that was concealed from you so you didn't know about it. But so I think we have to look at what things would have been different. You know, if they'd have had this video, they could have used it. You would like to think that the hospital that is treating your daughter, if they had something that helped with the situation, with the true situation, the true facts, they would bring it forward and give it to you. And if the DCF proceeding had really been a search for the truth about what was going on here, that you would have had that evidence. They could always give it to you and say, we don't think it's exculpatory, but they should have given it to them. So their parents were entitled to rely on saying, well, if they'd have had something, they're supposed to be taken care of. They're supposed to have her best interest in mind. That, I think, is reliance right there. I think that's our short response for now, Your Honor. If there's anything else you want me to cover in more detail, I'd be glad to try.
Well, what are you contending the elements of fraudulent concealment? Do you have a case?
They're actually, I think we, let's see, Butler versus Usom, I think. Is that the one? Let's see. I think Mr. Altenburn is correct that there's a standard jury instruction on that, and I think we don't really have much disagreement over that. So I can
comes like straight out of a tobacco case is where it comes from. And somewhere in the jury instructions there'll be a cite to that tobacco case, but I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. While he's looking, can I make a few points?
Yes.
Mr. Elgin referenced the patient bill of rights. That's in exhibit 2045-024. And it sets forth that you or your designee have the right to, and then under 15, get information from your doctor provider about your diagnosis, your test results, and outcomes of care. And that's important because Johns Hopkins has taken a position throughout this case that this video was for purposes of medical treatment. And so under the patient bill of rights of Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, if that's to be believed, Maya and her parents had the right to be informed about the test results and the outcomes of care, about what was revealed, what were the results, what was the interpretation of this EEG video, and that never happened. You also have the two risk management notes.
What are the damages if under that theory that if this was a medical test and then it wasn't told what the results were, what are the damages?
The damages are, it's a bit difficult to say conclusively what would have happened if. We can't know that. But we do know that there was a dependency hearing on November 8th and November 10th, and the parents and their lawyers did not have benefit of this video evidence to go show the court. Whether or not she manifested behavior that was consistent with complex regional pain syndrome or not, in fact, the justification the risk management notes was that they'd be able to see her walking on her own when no one was there. And that's in two different risk management notes, and okay from risk. So the damages really are, we've heard several times from the defense here, we can't get into the defense proceeding, and the way for this family to proceed was to bring this to the court. Well, if the video is concealed from them, how can they bring it to the court and get the relief they want, which is, if there's a shelter review hearing on November 8th and November 10th, and the judge sees that Maya is acting in a way completely consistent with her complex regional pain syndrome, it'd be over. The damage is everything from November 8th, November 10th onwards, and even if that ends at November 17th, that Maya remains in that hospital being mistreated, et cetera, et cetera. That's the damage.
And, Your Honor, it's an intentional tort, so I would think nominal damages would be something we'd be entitled to in any event. I believe the standard jury instruction is 409.7 for the fraudulent misrepresentation.
And Mr. Altenberg, any response?
First of all, the Bill of Rights is provided because there's a statute that requires the Bill of Rights to be provided. And that statute doesn't create a private cause of action. It doesn't, it creates a penalty by the state, and that is it. And so the Bill of Rights has been used here, and I think Mr. Elegant and I have agreed there can be evidence for some other standards, but the notion that we had a duty to disclose under that, A, is not in this complaint, in this count, and B, I don't really think that's legally accurate. But nevertheless, what they're alleging is that it had exculpatory things that would have changed the outcome of the case. Well, we can. They didn't put in the transcripts, so I'll be happy to let you read those transcripts if you want to, but that evidence was going to be used at a trial in February that never took place. And they had it long before that. Their allegations in paragraph 213 is that in reliance on this, they were forced to seek out psychiatric and other renowned medical experts in an attempt to prove this information that we already had. The information they've given you that we already had is 40 seconds of stuff that I'm not quite sure what it proves or disproves, that people are moving and handling this child who's supposed to be in severe pain, and she's not seeming to respond like she's in pain. But be that as it may, there's no evidence that they hired anybody because they didn't have this tape. There's no evidence, frankly, that in the next 30, 40 days after they had this tape that they hired anybody for the trial where this was going to be the issue. And so they have not proven that. And the notion is that we had a duty to disclose this because it had exculpatory things and we knew it was there. Again, there's no proof that anybody from the hospital had viewed this thing in that 30-day period to evaluate it either as proof in a medical abuse case or even for diagnosis, for that matter. They haven't put on any of that evidence.
Okay. Court's going to take the directed verdict motion with respect to count 20 under advisement. What's the next one, Mr. Altenberg?
The next one is medical malpractice. It will be shorter, I hope, in some ways, although the part as to Sally Smith may not. Plaintiffs have presented this medical malpractice case in a very unusual manner. They put no testimony from the primary treating physician. You know, the Dr. Hanna treated this child for 6 months or more and sat out in the hall, but he never ever came in here and spoke a word. So we know nothing other than what is in his records. As far as our treatment is concerned, they didn't put on a single doctor to testify about anything. They put in thousands of pages of records. Those records were used by their experts to review the way experts are allowed to do to render their opinions. So right now, if the jury went out the door, they'd have expert opinions and a big pile of paper. Now, first of all, by the way, that means you can't deny a motion for directed verdict unless you go read it, which you're not going to do. So at least this one has to be deferred, right? But more importantly,
you're assuming I haven't already looked at it.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't have if I were you. But at any rate,
maybe that's the difference between an appellate judge and a trial judge.
That could be. But the problem here is that may be sufficient in a case where you're talking about a sponge left in a body or an X-ray that hasn't been read. But we have a case that's about a complex regional pain syndrome that is a relatively new concept in medicine. It's complicated. There was fights about its diagnosis. And then more importantly, whether we should use a ketamine dosage that the experts aren't coming in here and say, well, that Boston's Children's Hospital does this and Nemours does this and everybody else does this. There's a guy in Mexico that does some of it, and there's a couple offices around here that do this. But the notion that this is generally accepted treatment by doctors, that's nowhere in this record. So my position is, and I'm going to tell you right now, there's no case law that says this, that you should not be able to just throw in 5,000 pages of medical records and put on your experts and tell the jury to go out and figure this out. That's not enough to prove a case. Beyond that, as to I want to talk about Sally Smith. And I think I might have had a bit of an epiphany Friday afternoon after listening to our discussions on that. And I think that the plaintiffs are conflating the concept of an apparent agent with something that I would call a gratuitous advisor for a treatment team. And this confusion is very likely to create prejudicial error in this case unless we can straighten this out. And the proper way to do this is to DV the sub-issue of whether she is an apparent agent. The case law, not just for medicine, but for a broad range of torts and contract law, for that matter, is very, very clear that an apparent agent is if the principal acts or by words or acts holds a person out to be his agent, and the plaintiff relies on that representation in dealing with the presumed agent, and the plaintiff changes his or her position in reliance on the existence of that principal or agency relationship, that then there is a claim. In a non-medical situation, for example, merely being a franchisee of Burger King and having a Burger King sign, that doesn't cut it. But if I'm a yard maintenance company and I have an independent contractor and I give him a big sign to put on the side of his truck that says Altenburn's Yards Business, and I give him a cap that says Altenburn's Yard Business, and he goes to someone and says, I want to be your yard man, and they say, okay. And he's out there mowing the yard and he runs over their child. He's an apparent agent for them because they relied on him to be one of the guys from Altenburn's Yard Service. And I'm going to be liable for him because I held him out by doing all those things to that person. Now, oddly enough, one of the reasons I've never been a big fan of this particular doctrine is the person going down the street when the yard man runs over a big rock and the rock throws and knocks their eye out. He's not an apparent agent for that person because they didn't do anything in reliance on the fact that he had an Altenburn hat on his head. And so it's a rather weird document. In the medical setting, we started using this mostly because hospitals started taking things inside the hospital and spinning them off to independent contractors. So the emergency room, the MRI unit, the X-ray unit, some other forms of testing groups suddenly all become some other group that's working inside the hospital. They sure look like they're part of the hospital. No one has a sense of they're not part of the hospital. And so when you go to the hospital, you rely upon the fact that the people inside there work for the hospital. And that's the Rosler line of cases. Again, I don't think that's the best solution, but that's the solution, and the legislature's never changed it since I said it was a bad idea. But what we have here is something that's different because Dr. Smith's not running a unit of any sort inside this hospital. She happens to have staff privileges at the hospital, and she's also the head of the CPT team that has a subcontract or a contract, I guess, with DCF. And so what we know is that when this child first arrives and the people in the emergency room or pediatric intensive care hear this story, they're concerned mostly about whether they have to report, they call the person they know is an expert in medical child abuse, which is Sally Smith. She's not an employee of the hospital, but she has staff privileges there, and they know what her other job is. And she gives them some advice. And the Kowalskis know absolutely nothing about that, and they didn't do anything to rely upon it. But that advice was given. And then a while later, after the report to DCF has been made, Sally Smith has been assigned to be the CPT investigator on this. And she apparently shows up at the hospital. And I gather these interviews with Beata and maybe Jack, at least one of them, occurs in the hospital. And she's got the evidence is she has a white coat on that says John Hopkins, and she has a tag on that says John Hopkins. I can live with that. But what did they do in reliance upon the fact that she has the white coat and that? They talked to a CPT investigator. And from what she heard, but more importantly from all the medical records that she quickly gathered up, she decided it was time to convince the lawyer at DCF to file a shelter proceeding. And that happened. Now, I got to tell you that if they had realized that she was from the CPT team that day and said, we're not going to talk to you, I don't think anything was going to go one bit better for them. And they certainly haven't proven that they wouldn't have gone to a Shelver hearing if they hadn't talked to this person at that point in time. That's a whole different subject. So there was no treatment done in reliance upon her being a member of the employees at John Hopkins. Now, from that Friday at the Shelver hearing where she appears as a CPT person, at the very latest at that point in time, they know full well that she's not an employee of the hospital. After that point in time, what's bothered you, and I understand why it bothers you, is that the team has collaborated somewhat with her, and when she finishes her report that she files with the court, which is like a 50-page report of all the medical things that this child has gone through in the 2 years before, that's put with the medical records. I guess not in the medical records, but somehow physically with those records. It's a report that's given to the state, but they have that. Now, the Kowalskis did nothing in reliance upon that. Their allegations have been, well, she recommended that a port be removed. I think if you look at the thousands of pages of medical records, you'll see that doctors at the hospital did the same thing. They advised Beata Kowalski that that should be done, and she said no, and they didn't do it. So even though that advice was given, nothing was done in reliance upon that. So what I'm trying to explain to you is that if you're looking at this properly, she's more like a gratuitous advisor to this team. And it's not so much whether or not she is negligent, but if that team itself relies on somebody and what they're relying upon is negligent material, and they should know it's negligent material, they probably breach a standard of care. And so the fact that they were considering this stuff, especially if it was bad stuff, and that an expert would say they shouldn't have relied upon, I'm not disagreeing that that's admissible. It just doesn't have a single thing to do with a parent agency. It's a whole different question. And the reason this is not a one-off in this case, because lots of hospitals, in addition to All Children's Hospital, have lots of people who have staff privileges at their hospital. People who work for these hospitals call them up for a bit of free advice when they're trying to figure out what to do as hospitalists and the like. If the staff privilege people, who right now the hospital has no liability for, and those people are not on the hook if they answer the phone, if all of a sudden they become apparent agents because they have staff privileges and they're contacted by the hospital, even though the patients know nothing about it and didn't rely on it, there's going to be a lot less communication from staff privileged doctors. So there's no reason to go this far when there's a proper analysis to this, just looking at our own doctors and whether they should or shouldn't have taken that into advice and whether that affected their diagnosis or, more importantly, their treatment while she was in the hospital. That's a whole different subject. So I'm moving for a directed verdict as to apparent agency on her because I do not believe that under the law of Florida that has been proven.
Are you complete with your argument?
Yes.
Mr. Allen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. To start with the medical malpractice, we don't just have thousands of pages of records. We have Dr. Duncan testifying that this was improper psychological care. We have Dr. Schopert testifying that they breached the standard of care in failing to properly treat Maya's complex regional pain syndrome. We have Dr. Neuberger testifying to multiple pediatric physicians breaching the standard of care. So there's plenty of direct testimony that John Hopkins committed medical malpractice. You don't have to wade through 5,000 pages of records to figure that out. It's right in the transcript from what I understand. Now, turning to the agency issue, I guess we're talking about pleadings. I'd say I don't think gratuitous advisor was pled as a defense. So we seem to be big on pleadings, but it's kind of like you can call her what you want, but she's really an agent. Apparent agent, at least, maybe an actual agent from what we see evolving. She is, in terms of what
judgment out the actual agent.
I know you did, but we're hearing more stuff now, and I don't know that we have to go there because I think we have the apparent agent is clear from what we have. She's escorted into the room
introduced to them not as somebody from outside, not making no distinction that she's outside the hospital or anything. They do talk to her. You know, I hear the argument today, well, you know, the Kowalskis didn't prove something would have been different if they'd have known the truth. Well, you know, they haven't said, well, the same things would have happened if the Kowalskis hadn't talked with them. That would be something that, you know, that would be a hospital burden. But we have Dr. Newberg again testifying that Jack and Beata Kowalski had reason to believe she was an agent and had authority to act, you know, given her routine presence at the hospital, all the different things she was involved in, including coming in, presenting the way she did with insignia and so forth on. And I understand Mr. Kowalski testified that he relied on her presentation. In terms of whether you even have to have reliance, the Rossler case that we're referring to, in which Mr. Altenburn did have a concurring opinion, say maybe we ought to just, you know, move away from this, you know, charade of people. A lot of times hospitals today want to act like they're just a flea market. They're just renting booths to people to come in and do things, okay? And they're, you know, we don't know what's going on over there when doctor's doing something, but they're not a flea market. And I would endorse if somebody ever got around to writing it, the view he expressed in that concurring opinion. But the more important thing for our purposes, I think, is the majority opinion. I don't think we have to go there because I think there's plenty of reliance, but majority opinion, if you look at page 1161 in footnote 3, it says that when you show up at the hospital, your reliance is presumed because you have shown up there. That's a second district opinion from 2003. So we think we've got reliance, and it's presumed. Now, I'm sure I don't know all the facts. Somebody?
Joseph, my point on this is, in terms of detrimental reliance, I'd ask the court to consider the testimony of Dr. Kirkpatrick and testimony of Jack Kowalski regarding the fact that Beata and Jack were on guard about misdiagnosis and problems with getting CRPS properly diagnosed. They were on guard about this. They walk in, there's a doctor there. Unbeknownst to them and to Maya, she is actually a prosecutor. You can call her whatever you want, but behind the scenes, her goal is a prosecutor. However, she's wearing a lab coat. It has the Johns Hopkins sign on it, according to the testimony. And she comes in and she doesn't identify herself. And then she takes down the history, which is in the record, but the history is designed to prosecute the Kowalskis. And the detrimental reliance is this. But for her being in there and presenting herself as though, and the hospital presenting her as though she were a doctor, they would have, if they had known she was who she really was, they'd have turned around and walked right out. If they relied on the fact that she was a physician with the hospital who was there to try to assist them and help with the child, but instead she was a secret prosecutor, I submit to the court that had they known on that first time, that first day, they would have turned around and walked straight out of that hospital and none of this would have happened. Had they known Sally Smith was who she actually was, instead of believing, based on the hospital's action, that she was just another doctor there to help. That's my point on it.
Anything further, Mr. Ellegant, before I let Mr. Altenburn have any brief rebuttal?
Nothing further.
Anything further, Mr. Altenburn?
I don't disagree that in the context of a hospital, if it's a radiology department, the presumption kicks in. That's what that case was about. That presumption hasn't been extended to people who are staff privileges who are called in that fashion. The standard rules apply on that. And what we're talking about is whether she is part of the team for medical negligence. And, I mean, the law is just very clear on that. As to what would have happened in the DCF proceeding, if they had blown her off, that's a lot of speculation, but I mean, her 50-page report in this wasn't based on what they told her, it's what she went and found out with subpoenas to get medical records from everywhere else. So I think that this is,
an issue that's chasing itself looking for some relevance somewhere that it just doesn't really have in the suit, and ends up allowing them to make Dr. Sally Smith the evil person, yet another one of our bad people, and that should not be taking place when this case goes to the jury.
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
Despiértate, que el $4 breakfast meal deal ha llegado a McDonald's. Incluye un sausage McMuffin o sausage biscuit, hash brown y un café caliente. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games. All for free?
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.